This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. We're going to go to some wild places today on the show, like learning about something called a diverging diamond interchange. We're going to explore the concept of time and how we came to use the measurements that we do today. Abenaki Chief Don Stevens will join us to talk about the COVID vaccine trial that he'll be taking part in. But first, burdock root. That's right, burdock root. Here's the deal. If you tell me about somebody doing something interesting and different in Vermont, I'm probably not going to forget about it. Several years ago, someone told me about a farmer in the Plainfield area who was growing burdock root for the Chinese market. I have no idea what that's about, but it wedged its way into my brain. So last week, I went about finding this farmer, and he's ready to teach us all about burdock root. His name is Richard Wiswall, and he and his wife, Sally Coleman, own the Kate Farm in East Montpelier, right on the border of Plainfield. Richard, thank you for being on Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick, good morning. How are you doing?
I'm fabulous. Listeners, if you've got questions about burdock root, or you're a big fan of it, call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Okay, Richard Wiswall, give us an overview of the Kate Farm today.
Sure. Well, the Kate Farm has been around since 1793 when the Kate settled it, and it was in their family for about 100 years, and that's why it's still called the Kate Farm. There's a Kate Farm Road. They sold out of the family in 1901, but the Kate Farm today has been, even though it's been farmed continuously for since 1793, is radically different than when it was back earlier on. Not radically, but we grow organic vegetables, certified organic vegetables, that we sell mostly locally in Vermont. We also are a member of Deep Root Co-op, which is a growers co-op based out of Johnson, which sells quite a bit of food into the Boston and New York markets. So we grow produce, organic produce. We also grow seedlings. We have 8 greenhouses where we start plants and sell them to area gardeners in the springtime. That's pretty much a springtime adventure. And then we also sell greenhouse greens, tomatoes that we grow in the ground in the greenhouse. And then in the fall, we grow burdock root, as you mentioned, which is kind of our it's a wholesale crop. We try to sell some burdock in Vermont, and people kind of look at us and laugh. we do sell some into the Boston or the urban markets, where there are Japanese markets as well as macrobiotic and health food stores that carry burdock for a number of reasons.
Well, we're going to get into the whole idea of the burdock root and why you went there, but you touched a little bit about the interesting history of the Kate Farm, started with the Kate family, and what kind of farm was it originally for that 100-plus years?
So it started out as a horse-powered farm, and so they would have a number of horses that would all, powering whatever operation they did, whether it was dairy or sheep. And so it was sheep before cows became more fashionable. So up until, I guess, in the 1800s, it was all sheep. And then from there, it was dairy primarily until Goddard College bought the farm in 1964. Goddard College owned it from 64 until 1981, which is when I landed here. And during those times of Goddard ownership, it was used as faculty housing. The Institute for Social Ecology was based here. And Bread and Puppet, actually, before the Institute was here, Bread and Puppet, before they moved to Glover, was here for 5 years and had their circus and pageant and a museum in the barn, even though it was much, much smaller back then. And, Peter and Elka and their 5 kids lived in the house here where Sal and I live. So it's got a kind of a colorful history, but generally it's been a sheep or dairy farm pretty much for 220 years. And then I've been doing this for 40 years now, growing organic vegetables.
It really does have a rich history. And then you come along in the 80s, yes, with organic vegetables. But you got this idea in about 1985 to grow something called gobo, or as we know it here, burdock root. So Kind of tell us what the heck burdock root is.
You know, one of the jokes in this growers co-op, I've been a member of this growers co-op since 1985, and I used to sell burdock root, celeriac, and dandelion, and they refer to me as a farm that grew inedible crops. but anyway, so back in the 80s, you know, that was a while ago, and the organic market was just starting to take off. In fact, when I first started trying to sell my product of organic vegetables, people would say, oh, it looks great, but it's not organic, is it? You know, and I said, well, if you don't want organic, you don't have to say so. But the market has changed dramatically since then, and back then I was trying to figure out any kind of, I try to grow anything that would grow in Vermont. So we had like 40 different types of vegetables that we'd grow. Mm. And we would experiment things with salsify and sclerozonera and dandelion root, all those kind of things, and medicinal herbs. And so burdock was one of those, and we started growing that. And it was, well, it kind of grows like a weed, but it's really hard to get out of the ground. And so the trouble is, you know, in the harvest end of things. And so we've worked over the years doing a number of different things and I made some custom-built diggers where we can actually get it out of the ground still by hand but with less trouble than we used to.
Well, Richard, every time I bring up burdock root to somebody, they talk about burrs and they curse the burdock root. So you're here today almost as the PR man for burdock root. First of all, tell us what burdock root is used for, and then, you know, why it shouldn't get such a bad rap about the burrs.
Well, the burrs, interestingly, is the actual inspiration for Velcro, which most people know about. Back in 1941, a Swiss engineer noticed the action of burdock burrs, and he actually took some time, but he developed what is now Velcro and patented it.
Wow.
So there's some perks of it, even though your dogs, you might not like it on your dogs or horses' tails. But what was the question again?
Yeah, so, okay. So, first of all, I think when you grow burdock root, you don't get the burrs, right? Is that, that's like when it goes to seed or goes to
seed. When it goes to seed. So, yeah. So basically a little biology here. You know, plants are either annuals or perennials, and then some are biennials, which mean they first year, burdock is a biennial, like parsnips or parsley or carrots or onions and cabbage. And so the first year, the burdock will set a big tap root, and then it overwinters. And then the following spring, it uses the root reserves in that tap root to set up a seed stock. And so the second year, if you were to drop a seed in the ground, 1 year, you wait a whole year, go over winter, and then the next year it would set up that seed stock that everyone's familiar with getting tangled up in your dog. So if you harvest it the first year, it's what we do. So basically early May or whenever we get on the ground, we sow seeds in the ground. They grow up and form a very leafy plant but no seed stock. Then we harvest it as late as we can in the fall, like usually October, try to get out before November 1st, and we store it in a root storage. And then as long as we harvest it all, then we have no burrs at all. But we actually do save some. We breed our own seed, and so we actually save some patches for letting it overwinter, like you would parsnips. The next year, they pop right out of the ground and set that seed stock, and then the following fall, we actually harvest the seed. We have a seed cleaner where we can clean it up, and then we use those seeds year after year, our own seed source. So in fact, biennials, burdock is very easy to control. If you have a pesky patch of burdock, if you mow it consistently all year long and keep that seed stock, if there are any second-year roots in there, from growing, the plant will die and you won't have any more problems. So it's just a matter of just that 1 year, just, you know, being diligent about going ahead and cutting those seed stocks.
That sounds great. Now, tell us, you drop some off for me, both the root and then it looks like some ground burdock root. It's got a beautiful, earthy, wonderful smell to it. But what is it used for, Richard?
So burdock, the root, the fresh root and the dried root taste a little different, but the fresh root it's really hard to describe tastes, but I would say kind of like a heart of a broccoli or a stem of a broccoli or an artichoke kind of flavor. You described it as earthy. I do eat some dirt, but not on purpose. But, you know, it does have that earthy taste to it. That it's a root vegetable that we generally don't eat like a carrot. We don't usually eat it raw. It's big in Japanese cooking. It's kind of like a staple in Japan where, you know, it's a, you know, that's what's for dinner kind of thing. And it can be sliced, you know, or julienned in stir-fried soups. I make tea out of it. You can pickle it. You can do it. Kinpira, which is a kind of julienne the burdock with some carrots and saute it, and then some soy sauce and a little sesame seeds on top. It's great. So you can, you know, add it simply just to any kind of soup or stir fry as an addition. But it's not like a sole go alone vegetable. My son will eat it raw, but he likes many things. I was going to say he's more adventurous. You can juice it. You can do those kind of things. But generally, it's cooked. And, you know, some people peel it. We usually don't peel it. But when the roots come out of the ground, imagine like a very long carrot. They'll grow 2 to sometimes 3 feet long. And the prize roots that we try to sell as number ones into the Boston market are maybe, 18 inches long and inch and a half in diameter, so long and slender. Then we have all these second roots, we call them seconds, because they're either forked or branched or misshapen, that are perfectly usable, and we take those and we dry them whole, and then we chop them with a hammer mill, and that's that little bag of dried burdock that you have, and that you can, simmer or steep as a tea. I usually drink burdock tea 3 times a week with some, Tulsi tea or some other herb. And, with a little squeeze of lemon, and it's a nice tonic, really. It has kind of a dandelion, if you've ever drunk dandelion tea, the same kind of thing. Same family as well. Very good for you. Think about burdock root, it's a culinary vegetable in Japan, but it's an incredible medicinal powerhouse. It's loaded with antioxidants, but it also uses a blood purifier. In fact, even back here in East Montpelier in the 1800s, they grew burdock because it was known as a diuretic. It's also really good for skin issues. It's a main component in this SEAC formula, which is used for cancer patients. We sell some to cancer patients as well on our website. The taste is, again, it's kind of, I want to say it's kind of woody, but again, I don't eat wood, but that's what I imagine it would taste like. I brought you those over so you could either smell it, because it's got a very characteristic smell, and you can also just gnaw on it or try putting some in a tea, and so you can get a sense of what it's like.
Absolutely.
Rick, let's face it, burdock will never be the thing that the kids run home from school to get out of the refrigerator.
Except your son, of course. Richard, you said that you started growing this back in 1985. So how did you stumble upon the idea back then?
Well, let's see. A neighbor actually was growing it and grew it for a year or maybe two and then decided not to do it. And so I said, well, I'll try it out. And so that's how it kind of started out here. And back then, it was a much smaller market. We were, it's not a big seller. It's a very niche market, and so it's not like it flies out the door. But we do sell kind of just a slow and steady through the normal marketing channels in Boston and New York. It keeps very well, so we can actually keep it in a root storage like a carrot or parsnip or a potato, 2 to 3 months or more with ideal storage conditions, which we have been working on as well. I did want to point out, too, that, the burdock that we grow is called giant burdock or a Japanese burdock. It's a different species, but it looks very similar to the wild burdock that you see. It'd be hard to tell the difference looking at the tops. But I do know that buyers in New York will snap a root and be able to smell if it's a wild burdock or if it's a Japanese burdock. I don't have that refined sense of smell. They, you know, it's maybe like a wine taster. They develop these skills.
You must feel some bit of gratification that now, over the last, I don't know how many years, but celeriac has really come into vogue as something that people are loving to cook with, and you were growing that back in the 80s.
So, you know, celeriac is one of those sleepers. It's actually really popular, just like burdock is very popular in Japan. Celeriac is very popular in Europe. It's one of the top five veggies. And, you know, here it's like, it's a hard sell. First of all, if anybody's ever seen celeriac, it is the world's ugliest vegetable.
And, worse than the jicama?
I think even worse than the jicama. And I've seen a lot of celeriac. And we try to make it look pretty with a knife, but it just doesn't work. That's another great, it's a great storage crop. It's got this unique, supercharged celery flavor, which is good. Soup, stir fries, grated fresh in a salad, just make a remoulade out of it. It's like it's a great crop. It's actually now becoming more popular. More people are familiar with celeriac than they were 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that your food is, your vegetables are distributed through Deep Root Organic. So tell us about that organization and what they do.
They're a growers co-op based out of Johnson, and I'm a big fan of cooperative anything but cooperative marketing. And so all these, like, 20 growers get together and they look at the marketplace, and mostly it was formed in 1985 to try to move product out of the state of Vermont so growers wouldn't compete with each other selling to the local stores like, you know, the Shaws or the Hunger Mountains or Hannaford's, and move it into the bigger urban areas to try to access bigger markets. And so we joined forces to do that, and that's a great modeling effort. It takes time to make all the, you know, decisions, but we'd identify how many cases of green leaf lettuce we're able to sell and then divvy it up between growers and then bring it down to hire a truck. And we have our own truck now. We also use other trucks. But you think about it, mostly the farms are in northern Vermont, some just over the border in Canada, and all certified organic, and, you know, selling 2 to 3 tractor trailer loads a week, you know, during the growing season, and this time of year too with a lot of root crops and squash into the Boston market. So it's a great marketing avenue, and we pay a cut of our sales price towards for commission to pay for the trucking and the marketing aspect of it. We own our own building in Johnson, and it's a very, well, it's a mature and well-oiled machine right now because it's been around for so long.
Gobo is the Japanese term for burdock root, but gobo is also a spirit that Caledonian Spirits produces with your burdock root. So how did that come about?
Interesting story. My wife was, you know, was the one, my wife Sally Coleman was the one who pioneered that whole effort because we were, you know, it was a slower year in the sales department, and meaning me and Sal. So we had extra burdock we were trying to sell, and so Sally brought it up to Ryan up at Caledonia Spirits, which was up then in Hardwick at that point, and said, here, try some of this for a test batch. And so they kind of said, okay, we'll try it, and this is maybe 4 years ago. And then the next year tried some more, and Josh, the mad scientist who, you know, makes all the concoctions, you know, figured out how to distill it and realized that burdock contains inulin, which is the same compound that's also found in the agave plant that makes mescal, and that you could distill it and have this burdock spirit that has a mescal flavor. And it's like, wow, that is the coolest thing in the world, that you could have a Vermont-grown crop turned into mescal, a mescal-like drink. And so they've, you know, Caledonian Spirits, Bar Hill, have done a great job of figuring out how to do this. And so we've been selling them second. So we take the fork roots and everything else, and they rewash them, and then they will process them into in a mash and then make the distillate. The product is really nice, but this year, unfortunately, because of the pandemic, Bar Hill has, you know, put this year's crop on hold just because they've been shut down forever, and understandably, and it's too bad. But hopefully in the future years, you'll be able to see more of that. In fact, In fact, Rick, you know, I've got 2,000 pounds a second that you might want to get into the business. You know, I bet you could fit, you could probably fit six pallets in your kitchen, no problem.
I'm sure I couldn't. So let's just go back to that spirit, though. You said it. So is it similar to a tequila? And what would you serve that gobo with?
I'm not a mixologist, mm-hmm. but Bar Hill is, and they do a very good job. In fact, they attracted these high-end bartenders from New York City, and I forget the name, Angel Share, I believe, is the name of the bar in New York. And they came up here to Vermont to do a demonstration, and they had a little open house kind of thing. So they have a whole lineup, and you could probably even go do their takeout and try some that way. But I haven't been there for a while because of the pandemic. But check it out. Your listeners, you can go out and go to Bar Hill or go on their website and see what they have there. I think they still have some from last year's stock, but I'm not positive.
You know, Richard, we pay a lot of attention to dairy farms in Vermont, but what is it like running a vegetable farm, and what are the challenges that you face?
I really love my job. Nice. What I like about it is that it's kind of continuously varied. I mean, there's inherent satisfaction in kind of growing plants and animals and seeing them grow and then producing healthy food for your community. I mean, that's a real win-win-win kind of situation. The challenges are, you know, I started out when I was young, green, full of energy, but, you know, kind of dumb. And, it, you know, now doing it for so long, I've kind of figured out a few things. And so the challenges are less, but, you know, I feel like, you know, I've got the plane to lift off and I'm at cruising altitude, but there's still curveballs that come out of nowhere. The challenges, I think, are probably the marketplace for, you know, just in terms of accessing more market. There's always the give and take of price point, and, you know, having people in the United States don't value food as much as other places in the world. And we have a very efficient, cheap food system in the U.S. Is it good food? I won't comment, but I will. But we're very good at efficiencies, but I think there's some costs to our food supply in that efficiency. So I think, you know, this pandemic, one thing that's happened is that people have really realized that we need to be, you know, more secure about our food chain, and part of that is by buying local product and keeping the farms that are around here, whether they're dairy or meat or vegetable farms or apple orchards or whatever, in business, so we have that ability to produce food locally.
And what advice would you have for farmers who want to try growing something that's out of the norm, like burdock root?
You know, I'm a big fan of being innovative, and I'm a big fan of people getting into farming. I'm always saying, though, you know, before you plant a seed, make sure you have a sense of where you're going to market it, because if, you know, you're going to plant celeriac without a market, and, you know, and the market's already serviced by, you know, five other growers, it's going to be a hard sell. You're going to do all the work and not be able to sell it. So a little bit of market research goes into farming, where you have to say, well, hey, you know, we rode the hemp train for a couple of years, the CD hemp train, and that petered out completely. We crashed and burned with that. But, you know, it's worth, we always are experimenting. We're always trying new things. And there's plenty of things out there, like sweet potatoes were never grown in Vermont. And now they're like, there's some big growers who, you know, make their whole living that way.
Mm-hmm. Richard Wiswell is co-owner of the Kate Farm. I want to thank you so much for being on Vermont Viewpoint this morning.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Rick. Thanks.
CBS News is next. Then we'll be speaking with Chief Don Stevens of the Abenaki Tribe about being part of the COVID-19 vaccine trial.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
back to the Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. With COVID-19 cases at record levels in Vermont and surging nationally, the need for a vaccine is as pressing as it's ever been. UVM Medical Center is participating in a Phase 3 trial for a vaccine by AstraZeneca. Researchers there wanted to gather more data on the vaccine's effects on Native American people, and when they asked the local tribal leader, he personally stepped up to get the vaccine, and he joins us now. Don Stevens, chief of the Nalhegan Band of the Kusik Abenaki Nation, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. It's nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you. And you can ask Chief Don Stevens about the trial. You can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And, Chief, I'm going to take a step back and just ask you, because a few years, the pronunciation of the word Abenaki, we also learned it could be Abenaki. And which is the pronunciation you prefer?
Abenaki is fine. I think Abenaki or Abenaki is it's like potato or potato.
Okay.
I mean, Abenaki is more of the representing the Canadian kind of inflection, and Abenaki is more the English inflection.
All right, we'll go with the English inflection because truly that's how I've said it most of my life. So, Chief, why were researchers seeking out members of the Abenaki population for this vaccine trial?
Well, I think as a minority population, we're often overlooked, and they didn't have a lot of data on basically effects of any vaccine trials, I think, nationally. So, being working in partnership with UVM in the state of Vermont, they decided to try to be inclusive and give us a call and see how we could participate.
And you stepped right in to participate. Obviously, that's a personal decision, but what message do you hope to send as a leader by participating?
Well, first, I mean, as most leaders would, is you wouldn't ask your people to do something that you wouldn't be willing to do yourself, right? And I think being a respected leader in the community, that if I'm okay, then it might give others it might ease their mind if a vaccine is created, and they might be more willing to take it, because if we lose elders or the most vulnerable people, Every life, Abenaki life, is precious. So we need to protect all of our people, and including if we can help society as a whole. I mean, that's ultimately the goal, is protection of our people and our, you know, and society as much as we can.
How many Abenaki are in Vermont at this time?
Well, I think on tribal rolls, they're anywhere between 4,000 up. There could be a lot more on the rolls, but people are still in fear of coming forward or being on a list, or, you know, there's a lot of history with Vermont, and it's taking time to get over some of those wrongs that were done. And, you know, my goal as a leader is to try to move us past that. I mean, there's many others that are working on the same goal, but mm-hmm. we need to try to move more into a partnership role instead of keep remembering the detrimental things that have happened to us.
Well, I hate to bring it up, but it is important, I think, for Vermonters who aren't aware of some of that history of why Abenaki are afraid to come forward, even all these years later.
Yeah, well, our history was denied to us, that, well, we didn't exist. We lived somewhere else, which gave people the ability to take our resources and our homeland and all kinds of other things. Plus, then there was the eugenics survey that happened that was done by UVM Zoology, the head of zoology, Henry Perkins, and the 1931 Sterilization Act that was passed in Vermont. My grandmother was listed in that survey and had to change her name 3 times to avoid the sterilization from being, you know, basically captured and sterilized. So, you know, my goal when I started all of this was to make sure that our people could be proud of who they are and to be able to stand up and say, you know, we're proud Native people. And yes, we had some things that were done to us that were wrong, but we're survivors, not victims. You know, maybe my grandmother might have been a victim because she was directly impacted. But myself, as a two generations down, we're basically survivors of that, because if she would have been sterilized, I wouldn't be here talking to you or doing the work that I'm doing.
Has that abated some, or is there still a significant barrier yet to overcome there?
There's still a lot of fear. I mean, we're making headway. I was able to get the UVM Tom Sullivan to do the apology, you know, for the eugenics survey. And I'm working on the state. They had a bill last year before the COVID hit on apologizing for the their role in the eugenics survey. But, I mean, there's still a long way to go. If you ask UVM what their demographic statistics are, and can they list Abenaki people going to college, they'd probably have one or none. But we know Abenaki people do attend. They just don't come out and admit it. And, you know, it's basically like that in a lot of places when you were the minority population in Vermont.
Chief, since you decided to volunteer for this trial, what have you heard from other Abenaki people here in Vermont?
I think both thanks for stepping up and doing it for people, because if they find something, they're going to find it on me and not others. So thanks, and, you know, hey, you're brave and all this, and you know, you're doing a good thing. But there's also fear, too, that, you know, they could, you know, something could happen to me or others in the population, right? So it's like any other race. I mean, you're going to have both pros and cons and fears and excitement and a little bit of everything. So it's a mixed bag.
I'm not sure how much you can reveal about the trial, but what can you tell us about what it will be and how long it will last, where you are right now with it?
Yeah, I think UVM would be better suited to speak to it, but I can tell you that it was the AstraZeneca vaccine, and it's a two-year trial. And we will be brought in periodically, I think 7 or 9 times throughout that study, to get blood work and see how it's affecting our blood work and our antibodies. And I know that we have the ability to opt out if a vaccine is approved and we want to get that other vaccine if we wanted to leave the trial. I mean, but we don't know if we got the placebo or the actual vaccine. So the only way we would know is if we stopped the trial. So that's basically what it's about. I'm hoping it's really effective, but you would need to know more about it. You'd have to talk to UVM, and I think Beth Kirkpatrick is the leading doctor.
You stepped up, but did you have any reservations yourself before you said that you would be part of this trial?
Well, you always have reservations, a little bit, right? But I figured the risk of I am at high risk. I mean, I tell people I'm at high risk. I have diabetes and, you know, I have sleep apnea and a few other problems. And I fit into their category of people they wanted to test. So, I mean, on the flip side, yes, you're exposing yourself. But the other way is that if you do, you know, you have a chance to get some immunity if the vaccine works. But also, you will get good care. If you do get sick, you'll really get good care, because they want to find out what caused the problem, right? Was it the vaccine or something else? So I think the risk of the vaccine, in my mind, was, and the vaccine trials, was less than the actual COVID disease or the virus itself.
When were you first approached about this?
A few weeks back. I was approached just to see who in the community would be interested. They hadn't had a lot of success in some of the minority populations because of the fear and of trust and not understanding what might be happening, because some people didn't want to feel like they were guinea pigs, see what might happen to their population. So they reached out to me, and I knew that it might be a challenge to get people in the Native community because of those trust issues. So I said I would volunteer and take on that burden and see what happens. And then we have had other Native people step up because I was doing the trial. They decided to step up and be part of it as well.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I think that'll help. I think not only that'll help find anything if there's a problem, but I also think that it'll ease the fear when the vaccine does come available that people will get it just to protect themselves. So I'm hoping, that's my hope, is that we could be the bridge or the gap to make sure that people understand that there's risk in everything in life, but it's okay.
Chief, I wanted to ask you, what are the resources that are available to help Native people living here in Vermont?
There's not a lot of special resources to help Native people. We get the resources the general population get. As you know, we're recognized. They put in the bill that we didn't get anything special that other Vermonters didn't get. Do we have access as being a tribe to COVID funds? Yes, we have been considered as a minority population to get some COVID funds. So I am working with the state to help get some help or some relief, whether it be through food programs or just a variety of things to help our population. But that's available to other populations as well. So we're not getting anything special, but we're often overlooked as a minority population. People don't think of us as being minority or disadvantaged or even still here, and that's part of the problem, is that when all of these programs come out, sometimes we're often overlooked, and we don't have the financial resources to be able to have we have a nonprofit, but we don't have any employees because we don't have the resources to be able to have that. So not only do we become lower on the rung just from an observation viewpoint, but also we don't have the people to put the time in to be able to lobby and get those resources needed. So we continue to fall further and further behind other minority populations.
Mm. I understand you have a partnership with NOFA. Is that correct?
We do. It's been a great partnership. One of the things that I wanted to do is I was part of the 5-year health assessment with the state, and Native people have a high health disparity. It's one of the highest health disparities in Vermont, the diabetes and not eating healthy foods and not having access to healthy foods. So I helped start the program to work with colleges and NOFA to grow our Native foods, to be able to help educate the people who are growing it, but also all of the produce that was delivered or grown would be delivered to our people throughout the winter. This year, I think we did over 600 pounds of 500 and some odd pounds of squash, probably 100 pounds of beans. And I also work with the Fish and Wildlife Department who provide us with wild game like moose or bear that might have been hit on the road or that were still viable. Mm-hmm. To be able to provide for our people. So it's been a great partnership.
What can Vermonters do to learn more about the Abenaki tribe, to support the Abenaki tribe?
They can go to our website. It's www.abenakitribe.org. You can get there through .com as well. We have a lot of information on our website. They can donate to us there. Other tribes have their own means of being contacted. You can Google any of our tribes, but we have a lot going on. Mohegan's doing really well. Other tribes probably are doing their thing too, but they have their own government structures. So, yeah, I think just learning about who we are, making sure that we're part of their thoughts. This is November, Native American month. to help celebrate our existence, our continued survival in Vermont and beyond.
I'm speaking with Chief Don Stevens. He's the chief of the Nauhegan Band of the Cusick Abenaki Nation. And, Don, where is Vermont in the move to recognize all the bands of the Abenaki?
Well, they've recognized four. There was one intertribal group that wouldn't be eligible, and I think one of them were denied. So I don't know of any other tribes, per se, in Vermont that have applied in a few years. I think they've covered everyone that's here so far. Not that others can't come up and prove that lineage. Unfortunately, we're the only race of people that can't self-declare. I mean, only horses, dogs, and Indians need pedigrees, right? I mean, we don't go and ask people how black they are, how white they are, but people want to know that we're real. Mm-hmm. And we can't self-identify, so which is sad all by itself. So we have to go through that process. So, I have a great relationship with Vermont, and I partner well with them. We've really grown that relationship over a few years.
I remember when you were going through that. Why was it important to get that state recognition?
Well, we never needed recognition to prove who we are because we know who we are. Right. I mean, you know, it's just a legal status that makes the European society comfortable with knowing that we are truly who we are. And it also gives us some kind of authenticity in their mind, because a European government has put a rubber stamp on who we are. So, and it opens up more opportunities to have a seat at the table. And to be able to ask or petition for help or for scholarships or other things. So we didn't need it for ourselves. We needed it to continue to help our people and help our children to compete with others that are more fortunate.
Is federal?
I'm
sorry, go ahead.
That's why we decided to do it.
Is federal recognition ever something you'd pursue?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd never rule it out, but I don't think we have no interest in pursuing federal recognition at the time. It takes about 20 years, $20 million, and the state has to be able to want you to get it for whatever reason to allow the federal delegation to work on your behalf, because the federal delegation works on behalf of the state. So the state really has no interest in seeing us federally recognized, and we would have to kind of compete against the state, like what happened in 2006, to be able to get federal recognition, because we would be on the same level as them, and they don't always like not having that control.
Right.
So we are making headway now, and we have access to things we need. So for me, I would rather continue to work on partnering with the state and uplifting our people, like we did with the hunting and fishing rights and their place names and all those things, than to fight for some European status that's going to get us, we don't know. But we do know that what we're doing now is working with the state and helping our people. So that's my opinion. Other tribes may have other opinions, but I don't think anybody has that on their table or their radar right now.
Give us an idea of the extent of the Abenaki people before European colonization.
Well, the status, I mean, obviously we were coast to coast, and we had a thriving trade. We had everything a civilized society would have, right? I mean, we weren't uncivilized, savage people. We had societies, we had governments, we had laws and rules, we had trade routes. What really hurt us is when the Europeans came, we tried to help Europeans survive the first winters and the plague and disease really wiped us out. So, I mean, we've been through this coronavirus type situation before. Now everybody is feeling that. I mean, before Europeans were kind of immune, but now we're we're all in the same boat. So.
Yeah. Don Stevens, chief of the Nohegan Band of the Cusick Abenaki Nation. It is always great speaking with you. Thanks for being on with us this morning.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate it. Adio, nanawamazi.
CBS News is next. Then we'll be back with more on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. There are people in this world who ask a lot of questions, difficult ones even. And then there are people like Joe Mazur who go try to answer them, and he writes books about them. Among his past quests, he's looked at how all those symbols we use in math developed. In his book, Fluke, he dove into calculating the odds of anything happening, including some that seemed like the wildest coincidences. Now he's decided to look at the concept of time. Joe Mazur is a retired math professor at Marlborough College, and his new book is called The Clock Mirage, Our Myth of Measured Time. It's published by Yale University Press. Joe Mazur, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, if you've got time questions, you can hop on the phone 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Joe Mazur, why was this your latest pursuit, this pursuit of learning about the concept of time?
Well, because time has always been my pursuit. I've been thinking about this for it seems like forever. But in every one of my earlier books, there is some kind of question of time that comes up in a chapter or two. And there's something about time that always has interested me. And so I'm really, you know, this is nothing new for me. I've been working on thinking about this for years and years. But the past 4 or 5 years, I've really gotten into reading an awful lot about what people have said about time.
Was there much to draw from as you researched the topic?
Tons of material. I mean, there are hundreds of books on this topic, possibly many thousands of papers and essays that have been written in the last, I would say, 2,000 years, starting with Aristotle and continuing through the 17th, 18th century, a lot of stuff on about time. It's really a topic that nobody can really get a grasp of because you just once you start digging, you keep digging, and it looks as if nobody really has any great answer as to what it actually is.
Well,
what
Joe
is
Mazur,
time is the real big question.
We're going to hope you got a grasp on it as you researched and wrote this book. So when did we start using this standard of telling time that we use today?
The standard of time is it goes back to the late 19th century. In 1884, there was an international conference of 26 countries that decided that it's about time to standardize time. you see how it is that when you talk about time, you talk about time and you're using the word all the time. It's so ubiquitous, you can't get away from talking about it. At this international conference, there was this whole question of what does it mean to have time in every little town, in every little city, to be different? You know, if you were living in Washington, D.C., for example, in 1884 or before 1884, your noon time would be one thing, it would be 12 noon. And if you went to New York City, it would be 12:12. It was not, there was no standardized time. Time was where the sun was at that moment. So, you know, if you were living in New Jersey, even, it would be 12 noon in Washington, D.C. would be something like 12:14. So it's a very different kind of way that we would run, you know, we would synchronize our lives. The real issue was the trains. The trains had to run on specific time schedules and be very careful not to crash into each other on crossing tracks. So this issue really started to come out in the 1820s when trains were 1820s and 1830s, that when trains were on tracks and running from one city to another. That was the critical thing that started us to think about having a universal time all around the world, so that we could figure out what is time for everybody.
How did it get standardized then, Joe?
Well, as I say, this was a international conference. 26 countries were involved, and they decided to make a specific one time to be Greenwich Mean Time. That is, Greenwich Mean Time was when noon is when the sun was at its highest position over Greenwich. That would be established as Greenwich Noon, and then everything was divided over the entire Earth, the circumference of the Earth, into 24 time zones, and we decided to have those 24 time zones. And of course, that's where we are now.
Joe Mazur, it takes the Earth 24 hours to make a full rotation, so hence 24 hours in a day in the 24 time zones. But why 7 days a week? I mean, couldn't we have had 3 10-day weeks in a month, or 2 14-day weeks?
We sure could. I mean, there's nothing to stop us from doing that. That's true. There is, you know, there are all sorts of questions about why seven. Of course, the seven has very much a religious overtones, where you think that God created the earth. If you think about this, God created the earth in 7 days, and the eighth day was a rest period. So, actually created there in 6 days, and the seventh day was rest. So
right.
there is that, but then there's other reasons for it, because, you know, you have questions about lunar calendars. For example, lunar calendars were very, very, very in vogue back in 2000 years ago to about the 17th century, even in many countries. And lunar calendars suggest that, you know, the moon makes a new moon. You see a new moon in 28 days. And it's a very nice way to figure out, to sort of divide, the four phases of the moon into seven. And so if you're thinking about what seven really means, in terms of the number of days that you want to make into a cycle where things repeat, that is, you know, you have your work and you have your rest. And so where are you going to break it? Well, if you followed a lunar calendar, then you might think that, you know, the moon, you wouldn't want to have it any less than 7 days, because after all, you know, it's a question of, it's too short a week, a work week. You wouldn't want it too long, because you need that rest. So where are you going to break it? Well, the lunar calendar suggests that you might want to break it when you have the four phases of the moon separating the 28 days, which is the full cycle of the moon.
Which would give us 13 months a year, but we have 12. what I would really like, Joe, is 8 days in a week with a three-day weekend every
yeah.
week. Can we do that? Can I get that enacted anytime soon?
Well, talk to Congress about that and talk to have another international conference.
It might be high time for a new one. What devices have we used to tell time before clocks and watches?
Yeah, well, of course, it all starts with anything can actually be a thing that's going to tell us time. You know, sand falling off a cliff, you know, the number of grains of sand or whatever you want to, you know, pouring sand from one jar to another slowly would be a way of deciding how much volume you have accumulated as the sand falls, and so you can measure that as a, you know, buckets of water falling as a wheel turns. That was one way of telling time. Those are water clocks. You know, bars on the ground making shadows from the sun's rays. That would be another way. Swinging pendulums, you know, counting the number of swings of the pendulum. And then you get into things like molecular and mechanical vibrators, crystals and quartz and things like that. And then, of course, from there, you go into electrons moving from one state to a higher one. That's what we think of as an atomic clock now, radiating protons. Radiating protons have stable frequencies of exactly something like, and if I can remember this correctly, about, well, I don't know, billions and billions of hertz per second. So it's really counting. What we do is we count photons. We can know how the photons actually are running off from electrons moving from one state to a higher state. So what you do is you take some kind of atomic crystal, and you find that you have a counting. In other words, every clock is counting something. So it's a counting process. That's what you really want to. I don't know of any clocks that aren't something that's counting something going on. And that's what a clock is. And that's the way you measure time. But measuring time doesn't tell you what time is. We still have this problem. What is it that we're measuring? We don't know. I mean, we know some things of what it should be, but we don't really know. We can't put a finger on what it is. And even the physicists can't tell you that. In other words, they know what time is in terms of what it is in a mathematical equation, because they use it as a kind of a variable, a mathematical variable. But that doesn't tell you what it actually is.
Difficult to define, but I believe you say in your book that time is the most commonly used noun in the world, which is really incredible.
Well, in the English language.
Right. Joe, at the break, we had a call. Somebody wanted to know if you're familiar with the work of Robert Warnstein and his look at time.
I'm not. And as I say, there are at least 200 books that are fairly current, going back about 20 years, let's say, on time in one capacity or another. And most of them are physics books. And this is a book. My book is, it has a couple of chapters on the physics, but it is not really about the physics of time.
All right. So in it, you look at some things like an Olympic athlete winning a race by 1/1000th of a second.
Yeah.
What is that? I mean, is that even measurable, Joe?
Well, not to us, it is not. But to the racer who wins, and the one who loses as well, That is, you know, they have this sense of that time as like, according to them, they have this sense of this, of that kind of precision. As they come down, this, the particular case that we're talking about is, peekaboo, at an Olympic, slalom racer. And she had, the sense of, how close she was to her time as she came down. I mean, these things are dreamt. They're, you know, she sleeps with this, the image of coming down the slope. She can reconstruct the slope over and over and over again in her mind within, seconds of, not microseconds, certainly, but really very close to precision of how fast she's actually coming down within her own mind without actually doing it. It's just, you know, she can fantasize it and she can reconstruct it in her mind. But then, when it actually comes to the actual event, the live event, she also has a precision that compares it to what she has seen before.
And unlike a sprint on a track where you're running side by side with a person who you can see, right?
That's correct.
Running down that slalom by herself, just racing against the clock.
That's right.
Joe, are there cultures where time is less of a concern? And I think about when I lived in Miami and when we'd go down into the Caribbean and people referred to it as island time. People of Cuban descent would often say, well, that's on Cuban time, meaning they run, you know, at a slower timetable or pay attention a little less to the clock. But is it a cultural thing? This
absolutely it is. Yes, it certainly is. I mean, you know, in India, time is very different than it is in Vermont. And the time in Vermont, in fact, I think culturally is very different than time in New York City. I mean, you know, there are meetings to attend. There are social meetings to attend. There are business meetings to attend. There are all sorts of things that go on in your awareness of time that is very different from even one city to another. I mean, it's just and then there are countries, whole countries, where time is very lax, and other times where it's very precision. German time is extremely precise. Indian time is not, and certainly African countries, it's very relaxed as well.
That we measure with miles and kilometers, temperatures, Fahrenheit and Celsius. Are other units of time used anywhere else in the world different from what we know here?
I don't know of any.
Good. It was a question that occurred to me, and I thought, well, if anybody will know, Joe Mazur would know that. Everybody is on a standard of time.
Look, you know, I know an awful lot about time, but I don't know everything about time.
Let's talk about time as it relates to our human body. We hear sometimes about internal clocks, but is our body, in a timing system of its own?
Absolutely. It's very much controlled. You know, every organ in the body has cells that are doing work for the organ. For example, they're mostly building proteins during the day and during the evening, and they go on a very precise, fairly precise schedule of doing this. And they're building proteins. Some of the proteins are used, some are there, and they're actually being assembled in the cells of these organs. And those the manufacturer of the of those proteins are synchronized by a particular part of the brain, which is called the has a very very long and impressive name, the suprachiasmatic nucleus. It's a certain part of the brain which is very close to the pineal gland. So there's a lot of information that is being given by the eyes, actually, which is interesting. I think that's an interesting part of it, because sunlight and daylight come and go, and we notice it by the eyes, and that information goes to the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is synchronizing all of the cells in terms of what they're supposed to be doing, the manufacturing of proteins, which, after all, those are the building blocks of keeping us healthy and alive. And now, you know, you look at the thing that we have eyelids, for example, which cut out most of the light, but about 20% of the light comes through the eyelids. I mean, if you look, you know, you're sleeping and daylight comes, and your brain is actually getting information that daylight has come. It actually has that information. So it's very much linked to the circadian rhythms of the solar system. So your body really is in sync, in many ways in sync, with what's going on externally with the daylight. There are all sorts of genes that are doing a lot of work that are telling us that we are living in a particular place which has a sun and moon and everything else. If you were a being from a different solar system, you would have a very different way of synchronizing whatever you're doing.
Well, Joe, I want to talk about, I grew up with a father who had me late for everything, and I now own about 50 watches, and I'm very punctual. Now, can my dad blame his terminal lateness on his genes, his cells, or is the concept of being late or on time something a more of a learned trait?
That's a very good question. To answer that question, I think you'd have to do an enormous survey of how these things actually, as you said, there's a cultural thing, and beyond the culture, there is something that is characteristic of the person as well. So I'm not sure that it's, you know, it has anything to do with blame for one person having a more precise understanding of time than another. I mean, it's a matter of, I think it's really a matter of paying attention. So it's a question of how much attention you pay to time itself externally. Some people are very precise. That might have something to do with their background in terms of how they were brought up, or what city they lived in, or what country they lived in, what their parents taught them. So I would suspect that it's all of those things.
Joe Mazur, I know you like to take on the biggest questions in this world. So what are you curious about next? What might we be talking to you about in another year?
Yeah, well, I can't tell you that way ahead. But I am thinking of writing another book about time, because there is something that is, what's happened is that the physicists have hijacked the idea of what time is. They give us some notion that whenever they write a book about time, it's all about the physics of time. And, you know, the Big Bang and the beginning of time that way, and that time is relative, and that time has these physical properties that we should be that are quite interesting and extraordinary, and counterintuitive, and it just makes us wonder much more than because the counterintuitive aspects of time are so exciting. But my feeling is that I want to sidestep all that physics and realize that, in fact, there's something else going on. That's the personal time. That we have to understand that better than we do. And then my other new thing is to see what is time going to be like for us in the future. So I'm really looking at some chapters now. I'm writing some chapters about what time is going to be like for us in the future. And we see what time has done for us during this COVID.
Hey, Joe, you're not going to believe this.
Yeah.
We're out of time.
Okay.
Joe Mazur, retired math professor, and he's the author of The Clock Mirage, and it's published by Yale University Press. Joe, thanks so much. Always fascinating talk.
Okay, thank you, Rick. That's great.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to finish the show discussing something called a diverging diamond interchange. It sounds wild, like some new fair ride that only the most daring of your friends would even contemplate hopping on. But a good many of us will soon be taking a spin on it when we're in the Colchester area, and we won't have a choice. So it's probably a good idea to know what and where it will be and how to safely navigate it. Here to tell us all about the diverging diamond is Michael LaCroix. He's the project manager for VTrans. Michael, thanks for joining us and educating us on this.
Sure. Thanks, Rick, for having me.
And listeners, if you have questions or comments about what VTrans is doing at the Colchester Interchange, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Michael, as best one can, using words and not illustrations, what is the diverging diamond interchange?
Sure. You make a good point about being verbal, and this is a very visual type of project, but I'll do my best. Essentially, what we are doing is we are modifying the existing tight diamond interchange, replacing it with a pretty relatively new configuration where traffic on the arterial roadway, so in this case it would be Route 7, actually travels to on the left side of the roadway in between the two on and off ramp intersections. So in this case, it's about 400 feet. And what that does is it allows for left-turning traffic to enter and exit the interstate freely without having to wait for a traffic signal to tell them to take a left-hand turn. And so in its essence, that's what it does. And inherently, there's an increase in traffic capacity because those folks no longer have to wait for a traffic signal to tell them when to go.
And it's going to kind of snake around. So you're going to come up on Route 7 in your normal right-hand lane, and then you'll kind of shift over to the left and then back to the right.
If you were continuing on Route 7 through the interchange, yes, you would pull up to the first set of traffic signals, and you will cross the left side of the road when it turns green. And then at the far set of traffic signals, if you want to enter the interstate, you'll just slide right onto the on-ramp. Or if you want to continue along Route 7 to other points, you would wait for the traffic signal to turn green and cross back over to the right side of the road.
Michael, where was this concept developed?
Well, France has had a couple events since the 1970s. They weren't really utilized very much, but some folks that were really interested in diamond interchanges in the United States adopted a design and implemented it on a trial basis in Springfield, Missouri in 2009. And the results that they've seen as part of building that initial one has just exploded, has skyrocketed. There are currently over 115 DDIs in the United States right now, and there's another 140 on the books for the next couple of years, including ours. So state agencies across the country have recognized how useful and productive and efficient these types of interchanges are.
Okay, I would never have guessed that it has exploded that quickly, 100 in the 10 years since the one in Springfield, Missouri, another 140 in the planning stages. And I guess Vermonters, come on, I mean, if they can do it in Springfield, Missouri, master it, we can do it here in Vermont, right, Michael?
Absolutely, and that's part of why we're talking today. We're trying to get the word out to folks. The words that I am telling you are not doing it the design any justice. We're encouraging folks to come to our website, do some research on it. We have some videos that are extremely visual. Folks who can't seem to wrap their heads around how this is supposed to function and may get discouraged or intimidated by it, they will be enlightened by our videos. It shows and demonstrates very clearly how simple these types of interchanges function.
You really do just kind of follow traffic once the light changes. I mean, if you're, I'm going to come on 7 from the Costco side, and if I want to make a turn onto to go north on I-89, I would just turn off to the right. If I want to go south, it'll take me through the interchange over to the left, and then I make an easy left onto the interchange to head south. If I'm going through, it'll take me back to the right-hand lane, and then I head into Winooski. Is that correct?
You nailed it. You nailed it.
I might have to go on tour with you to teach this to people. so, Michael LaCroix, why this crazy thing? Because it really does look convoluted when one looks at it. Why this and not something like a roundabout that people have some, you know, already, you know, some history with?
Sure. Well, we did look at roundabouts, actually, for this particular location. Unfortunately, the size of the roundabouts required to accommodate all the vehicles that are expected here just didn't really work. The modeling that we did gridlocked. And we also considered just blowing up the whole entire interchange as well. But when push came to shove, the interstate bridges right now are actually in still pretty good shape. So it didn't make a lot of economical sense to, you know, destroy perfectly good bridges. So we had to try to find an alternative here that balanced, you know, accommodating traffic and all users, frankly, bicyclists and pedestrians, while still maintaining the relative, you know, existing footprint of the interchange. And the DDI really fit that mold very well when we were looking at it during our scoping phase. It was still pretty new in Missouri at that point when we started looking at it, but the more that have been constructed throughout the country, it just became evident that this was the best alternative for this interchange.
Well, you used the term blowing up the interchange. So there was this nuclear option you had. So I have to know, why? What's wrong with what's already there? What is wrong with this interchange?
Yeah, great question. If the Route 7 corridor in the southern part of Colchester didn't have problems, you and I wouldn't be talking today. And the Regional Planning Commission and the town of Colchester recognized that there was an issue here. But frankly, the root of the issue is that this area of the town is highly developed and is continuing to develop. And the existing interchange that was built in 1968, I believe, was not intended to accommodate the traffic that the development out there needs. Furthermore, there's safety issues out there directly caused by the traffic congestion because the interchange can't handle it. Recent high crash locations have shown that this area is the eighth highest in the state in terms of roadway segment, and it's the third highest in Vermont for injurious crashes, so automobile collisions, vehicle collisions that cause bodily harm to somebody. So those statistics alone really made it really pushed this project to the forefront, and we're trying to accelerate it and trying to get it constructed. And our hopes are the DDI, which across the country have shown 50-60% reductions in crashes across the country, should be able to fix some of the issues that this corridor is experiencing.
Michael LaCroix of V-Trans is our guest. He's driving us through the Diverging Diamond Interchange, or DDI. Michael, what did you think when you first heard of this Diverging Diamond Interchange concept?
Well, I'm a traffic engineer, Rick, so when I first saw this, I was ecstatic. But I am not the norm when it comes to things like this. So I would imagine that folks who are seeing this for the first time would just be stunned and shocked and probably far from excited, at least to the degree that I was. I'm always kind of looking at trying to think of different ways that we can try to increase the capacity for traffic and how to accommodate all users. So this was right up my alley, and I just attached to it right away when I first saw it.
What kind of skepticism have you had to overcome as you've been on the road talking to people about it?
Well, the primary concern from folks that we're hearing is that it's going to be too complicated. They're not going to understand it. They don't like the idea of driving on the left side of the road. One of the biggest questions that we get is if people have difficulty navigating the Winooski Circulator, how are they going to navigate this? And the Winooski Circulator is just a mile down the street, and it has, unfortunately, a rough reputation. But there are distinct differences between the two intersections, and part of what we're trying to do is get the word out and explain to folks how this project's going to alleviate those concerns. Our tools that we've been going on tour with prior COVID-19, unfortunately, like our animations and our simulator, have really opened people's eyes and have alleviated a lot of those concerns.
What kind of signage will there be there at that the new DDI?
Yeah, so we are going to install some brand new overhead signs in advance of the interchange. And we probably typically wouldn't, but in this particular case, we want to make sure that folks know which lane to be in before they get to the first intersection. Because it is crucial. You don't really want to be in the right side lane, the right-hand lane going through the DDI if you're trying to get onto the interstate on the far side of the intersection. So we really want to make sure we get folks lined up. So we'll have a bigger, robust signing. There'll be more of it in addition to those overhead signs.
Michael LaCroix, take us through the timeline for this project.
Sure. Well, we've been in design for several years. We just completed the design of it. We've been getting all of our permits, and we are acquiring some small strip takings from adjacent parcels. Once that's completed, the first phase of construction should be in spring of 2022. And we're looking at 2 to 3 years of construction. And it's going to be lengthy, unfortunately, but we really want to get in there, do the job right. A question that we get quite frequently is when, in terms of construction activities, and what we're telling people right now is that the majority of the work is going to occur at night. There's just too much traffic out there to be to fix this interchange during the daytime with all the traffic nearby. So nighttime night work is going to be a crucial element to getting this successfully built.
You mentioned the simulator, and so at my polling place in Colchester, I think it was a couple of years ago, there was that simulator. It gave people an idea of what to expect. You sat there, and the steering was kind of, you had to get that thing aligned, man. But other than that, you did get the concept of going through it. How did people receive the DDI once they were able to actually kind of drive your simulator and get an idea of what it'll actually be like?
The response was incredible. It was even more, it was more positive than we had even expected. We were also at the Champlain Valley Fair, not this year, obviously, but last year. And we had so many people that were concerned, and they came to us. We sat them down or their children down, and they watched their children play with it. And they were turned. We had turned their impressions of the project 180 degrees. And for us, that was proud. You know, we were very proud of that. But we still have a lot of work to do. Get the word out on this project. And we know we're not going to be able to reach everybody, but we're trying to get as many people as we can and make them understand, this isn't a big, bad, scary thing.
As far as not being able to take that simulator out on the road now because of COVID, how can people get a better handle who know they're going to be going through that interchange, even occasionally, to be up to speed on what it'll be like?
So we have a project website, exit16ddi.vtransprojects.vermont.gov. It's a mouthful, or you can just Google exit 16 DDI in the Google search and it should come up right at the top. We have a bunch of videos and animations there. We have some still photos of what the project's going to look like after it's completed. At some point, the technology is developing where we'll be able to get the actual simulator with the steering mechanism and whatnot onto the website. That technology is not quite there for us, but we're hoping it's there right around the time of construction. And even after construction, the education component of this project doesn't cease at the construction piece. So we want to continue to inform and educate folks about DDIs in general well after this project. So having that simulator on our website will be a crucial piece to that.
All right, I think we have time for a call. We've got Dean calling from Milton. Good morning, Dean.
Hey, good morning. My question is, there must be this design used elsewhere.
Yeah.
Are there successful implementations?
Michael LaCroix, you mentioned some before. Dean, we'll let Michael answer that for you. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, right now we have the United States has about 110, 115 DDIs already built and functioning incredibly. Another 140 on the books. States, particularly North Carolina, Missouri, Utah, those states in general can't seem to build them fast enough at their diamond interchanges. I know a couple years ago, I think North Carolina built 7 in 1 year. And those are the three big states right now, but I believe 48 states either have them built or are planning to build one. So they've really taken root.
This is at Exit 16 off of I-89. And for more information, you can search Exit 16 DDI, and you'll find the website from VTrans. Michael LaCroix, are there other places in the state where this might be considered?
Right now, there isn't nothing official on the books. I know the Regional Planning Commission was looking at a potential DDI at the interchange in Williston, but I don't think it's really gone much beyond some initial planning thoughts. So nothing officially on the books yet, but hopefully there will be soon.
And are you looking at other, I'm going to call it funky designs, but, do you research to see what's being done elsewhere to see what might work in certain circumstances here in Vermont?
Sure. You know, not necessarily for interstate interchanges. We also do, my group works on roundabouts and traffic signals. So, you know, technology is constantly evolving in the traffic signal realm of traffic engineering. So we're always looking to get the latest and greatest technology to test out. And same with roundabouts. We're looking at a different type of roundabout in Bennington right now, where the shape is not going to be circular. And so there's different, you know, things like that, you know, we're constantly looking for. So we're trying to be innovative and trying to, you know, not necessarily do it for the sake of being the latest and greatest, but if it makes sense, you know, money-wise or any other reason, then we'll certainly consider it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will tell you, Michael LaCroix, that I have been able to navigate on two occasions the triple roundabout in High Wycombe, England, driving on the opposite side of the automobile and the opposite side of the road. So I'm pretty sure Vermonters who are hardy and can figure things out should be able to make it through the Exit 16 DDI. That is the diverging diamond interchange. So we have some years, too, to kind of get prepped for it. I hope we all make it through easily. Michael LaCroix is a project manager for V-Trans. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rick.
All right. And that's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs and directed by Peter Cormier. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.